Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah News Roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. We've got a packed show today featuring reporting about Senator Mike Lee, about Utah Coal, Utah Lake, the Salt Lake City School Board, and the departure of Utah Jazz coach Quinn Snyder. And because it is so packed, I'll forego introductions this morning, and we will dive right into the conversation that I had yesterday with the Tribune's Brian Schott about a couple of his stories on Senator Lee and the 2020 presidential election. Take a listen. Brian Schott, Tribune political correspondent. Thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Anytime.
A couple of stories about Utah U.S. Senator Mike Lee that you reported on. And before we go to the January 6th stuff, you did some reporting on this appearance that the senator made on C-SPAN, where he appeared to glom on to election conspiracy theories. You know, I suppose, first off, why was the senator on C-SPAN on Thursday? What was he doing?
He was promoting his new book, Saving Nine, which is about the Supreme Court.
Got it. And you report that he got on board with the big lie about the election being stolen during his appearance, in a manner of speaking. How so?
During that show, they usually take phone calls, and they have I don't know if you've watched it, but they have a Republican line, they have a Democrat line, they have an independent line. Yeah. They went to the Republican line, and a caller from, I believe, Arkansas came in, and she was complaining about how Democrats were destroying the country. And then she mentioned the movie 2000 Mules, and said Biden stole the election, he's an illegitimate president, and she said it's too bad they can't go in and let him and get him out of the White House. In response, at first Senator Lee did not say anything about the election claims. He talked about baby formula prices, inflation, yeah, and the Biden administration policies in terms of that, but then the host asked him whether he thought Biden was an illegitimate president. And that's when he did this funny little rhetorical thing where he said Biden was elected by, he won the Electoral College vote, which is the only thing that counts, which is true. And he said, but he had seen the movie 2000 Mules, and it raised some questions about the election. And I don't know if you've seen the movie.
No.
I've watched it.
What is it?
A movie is put forth. It was produced by conservative political pundit Dinesh D'Souza. And in the film, it sort of makes this claim to expose a massive voter fraud where they got cell phone geolocation data in five states, and followed 2,000 people who they claim were dropping multiple ballots off at ballot boxes. They got this anonymized data, but they could follow individual phones, and they claim to have tracked people who visited these ballot boxes multiple times. They claim that there were non-profit left-wing groups who were paying them to do this ballot harvesting, ballot trafficking. The film does not deliver on any of those claims. It's been thoroughly debunked over and over again. But Lee said that he has seen it, and it raises some questions. Huh. And that caught my attention because this film does not even come close to delivering on what it claims. And I thought that was remarkable that he was giving it a tacit endorsement.
Brian, you have a clip from the C-SPAN appearance in your story, and I checked out that clip, and it sounds like Mike Lee is acknowledging that Biden is president, but I guess it's how he does that that is concerning. And again, that goes back to that Electoral College statement. Do you want to just sort of talk about that? Because if you're watching it and you don't have the context, it looks like there is Mike Lee, Senator Mike Lee, acknowledging that Biden is president, and therefore, you know, he is not a conspiracy theorist.
Again, he's trying to play both sides of this issue. He acknowledges that Biden was the winner of the Electoral College vote, which under the Constitution is the only thing that counts. But he said it doesn't mean that things didn't happen along the way, which is a fun little rhetorical thing. It's sort of a wink to some of the Stop the Steal crowds, some of the election fraud conspiracy groups. He's sort of winking at them, saying, "Yeah, I hear what you're saying," but without actually saying it. So he's trying to do both sides of this, which is what he has to, because this false claim, this false belief that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump has become orthodoxy in the Republican Party. If you go against that, you're essentially cast out into outer darkness. Republican base voters believe this lie that the election was stolen. There's absolutely no evidence to support any of that. But they believe this baseless theory, this lie, because it has been repeated over and over and over again by Donald Trump. It's a central part of his narrative as to why he lost.
Yeah, and I want to get to the January 6th Select Committee hearings and stuff. But actually, first, before I do that, on your, any response from the senator's office on your reporting on this C-SPAN appearance?
I did not hear from his office. I gave them an opportunity to respond. They did not avail themselves of that opportunity, which has sort of become usual from Senator Lee's office. I get a lot of radio silence. It's always quite interesting to see him pop up on Fox News and OAN and on C-SPAN and any number of friendly right-wing outlets. I wouldn't say that C-SPAN is right-wing main media. And again, he got a question that he clearly didn't want to answer in this one.
Yeah.
But overall, he's been doing a media tour about his book and sticking to outlets that are going to be much more friendly to him.
Got it. Okay, well, let's go to the other story concerning the senator. You and I are recording on Thursday. As we record, the House Select Committee on January 6th has not yet held their first public hearing. You know, their focus is the attack on the U.S. Capitol, an attack that was the culmination of an attempt to keep former President Donald Trump in office despite his having been voted out. Senator Lee says that he was not a part of that effort. You wrote a story this week about some new court documents that might prove problematic for the senator as he tries to bat away any connection to the plot to keep Trump in office. How are these documents, these court documents, problematic for Lee and what he is contending?
Well, you have to rewind back to the publication of the Bob Woodward, Robert Costa book, Peril, in which it was revealed for the first time that Senator Lee was given a memo from John Eastman, who was a lawyer working with the Trump campaign. And this memo detailed his sketchy legal theory that the vice president had the power to set aside the election. The vice president had the power to declare Donald Trump the winner. When that book came out, Senator Lee said that he spent a few days making phone calls, trying to investigate these rumors that there might be alternate slates of electors from states that Biden won, but these electors would be for Trump, which is what it would take under the Constitution for the vice president or for these electoral votes to be in dispute and trigger a different way of selecting the president. So that first came out in 2021. And that sort of raised my eyebrows, because he waited 9 months from January 2021 for that to be revealed in a book. So it was in September. Then in April of this year, we saw text messages between him and Mark Meadows that were leaked. And in these text messages, Senator Lee, his narrative that he did not see the email or the memo until shortly before the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, they were thrown under the bus, that he was texting with then White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows at the time, almost from the day that the election was called for Biden, offering help, looking for ways to help the effort to keep Trump in office beyond January 20th, to keep him in office despite the loss of the election.
Yeah.
The January 6th committee has been fighting with Eastman, the lawyer, to get a hold of some emails that he used an email account at a college he was working for. He claimed that there was executive privilege or attorney-client privilege. The the January 6th committee said, no, they're not. We need to see these. And so in this filing that happened about a week ago, if you look at the attachments, and there were 22 exhibits attached to this. So any young reporters out there, always download the attachments, always. So I was going through these attachments, reading them, and there was an email between Eastman and a person whose name has been redacted. That person was putting forward an insane theory that Trump should invoke the Insurrection Act, declare martial law, and hold the election again, overseen by the U.S. military. Eastman replied to that saying, I will not be a party to anything involving martial law or the Insurrection Act. Then he said, the only thing that matters is if state legislatures were to certify, were to appoint these alternate slates of electors. Well, if you look at the text messages between Lee and Meadows, Lee is mentioning multiple times his efforts to try and find these alternate slates of electors certified by state legislators. He said that's the only way that will create a path that will give him something that he can defend. So it seems now, clearly, you know, we don't have every piece of communication between Lee and Meadows and Lee and Eastman, but if they were not coordinating, they were certainly working in parallel with these alternate slates of electors.
And Brian,
so, you know, this sort of casts a doubt on his claim that he was just looking into to rumors.
I just want to quote one of Lee's text messages to Eastman. He says, I've been calling state legislators for hours today, and I'm going to spend hours doing the same tomorrow. I'm trying to figure out a path I can persuasively defend. And then it goes on, we need something from state legislatures to make this legitimate and to have any hope of winning. Even if they can't convene, it might be enough if a majority of them are willing to sign a statement indicating how they would vote, which is sort of, I mean, you said earlier that Lee originally had said that, you know, he was simply making phone calls to see whether or not these rumors about the potential of alternate electors from states was something that was actually out there. That text message seems to show him trying to find or advocating almost for a path for alternate electors. Anyway, core to this, that alternate electors idea, people who would go out and despite how their state had voted, they would simply choose to elect Donald Trump, which kind of gets us back to that C-SPAN appearance when you think about it, because when the senator says, he says that Biden is the president because the Electoral College chose him, he said that yesterday in his appearance on C-SPAN, which isn't false. It's just ignoring the voters altogether, right?
You notice the exact same thing that I did. He's very good at using, he doesn't specifically say what he means, but if you read between the lines, and he is very focused on doing things by the Constitution. Well, the only way that alternate electors would have worked through the Constitution is if they had been certified by state legislators. That's the only way that it would work. And he talked repeatedly about that in these text messages. Now, he says, since he ultimately voted to certify Biden's election, not to challenge the election results, as several of his Republican colleagues did, that vindicates him. But, you know, it's hard to look at all of his communications, all of these emails and text messages, and not come to the conclusion that he was in some way looking to either manufacture a way that he could sign on to this constitutionally, or trying to create a way that he would be able to defend challenging these election results. So he did everything but vote at the end. He claims that vindicates him, but, you know, if you look at everything leading up to that, he was almost, you know, he was almost 100% on board, just couldn't take the final step.
Wow, Brian, we're low on time, and so I'm sorry about this, but I'm wondering if you have any predictions for what we'll get out of the Select Committee. We don't know because we're recording before that first hearing, but, you know, will any of it involve Senator Lee? These are questions you probably can't answer yet.
I I don't know what they have. I don't know what new information is going to pop up. Given the fact that there was a lot of talk about these alternate electors, and there is a famous interview with John Eastman from National Review where they ask him about the memo given to Lee, and he said, "I don't know what you're talking about. I never gave Lee a memo." Then they showed him the passage from the book, and he said, "Well, you know, I don't know how Lee got the memo, but I was working with him on a broader project," and we don't know what that is because he refuses to answer on what that is. I hope we find out more. The day that I'm really looking for is Monday, because that's the day that the committee hearing is expected to focus on these alternate electors, these fake electors from these battleground states where Biden won, these electors coming from Georgia and other states for Trump. So that's where I'm really going to be paying attention to see if anything pops there.
You can find Brian Schott's reporting over at sltrib.com. Again, I'm Roger McDonough, and this is Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup, a partnership between KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Joining me now on the Zoom is Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. And good morning, Robert. Thanks for being here.
Hey, good morning, Roger.
Yeah, and just before we dive into some other stories, I thought I'd ask for your take on those two stories. One, the kind of partial nod to election fraud conspiracies that Brian Schott is pointing to on a C-SPAN appearance by Senator Lee. The other, the senator is seeming to have had, to be seeking a pathway to overturn election results, or at least talking about, those alternate electors as a conceivable path forward. I don't know. Do you have comments there? You're the news columnist at the Tribune. I figured I'd ask.
Well, I mean, they're both sort of playing with fire, I think, in a way. We've seen Mike Lee in the past. We've known for a while that Mike Lee was involved in this discussion about alternate electors and potentially reversing the proper outcome of the election, frankly. This is shedding more light on it, I suppose. The January 6th committee will be watching closely to see if we get a fuller picture of that. In last night's hearing, if you watched that, they made a passing reference to the John Eastman memos and the legal theory he was advancing, and the fact that it was baseless. We'll probably learn more about that, as Brian mentioned, as these hearings proceed.
Yeah.
So, I think we're all kind of watching that. The C-SPAN interview is, again, just we keep hearing this from people like Senator Lee, and it's undermining people's confidence in the system. We've got a system that actually is safe and works. And, Senator Lee keeps promoting these theories that, as this 2000 Mules movie did as well, that lack support and do real harm to our democratic processes. And I think that's really unfortunate that he continues to do that when he knows full well, as we heard in the hearings last night, the attorney general used a colorful term, calling these theories BS, that there was any evidence that there was irregularities that would overturn the election.
Yeah.
And this was adopted not just by the head of the Justice Department, but by many of his senior staff, including the president's own daughter. But here we have, a year and a half later, people like Mike Lee still out there promoting the fact that there were, that this election somehow doesn't pass the smell test. And I think people need to push back on that firmly and aggressively.
I'll just ask you this last question on this topic, which is if there are, if there's any kind of, not smoking gun, but implication that shows that the senator was involved in pursuing a more significant path to trying to overturn the will of the voters in the election, is there political fallout is the question. And maybe that's...
I don't think so. Just unless it is a true bombshell, because, people who are supporting Senator Lee are paying attention to what Senator Lee is saying and doing has been saying and doing for the past year and a half. And they accept it. They're fine with it. They've reconciled that they're okay with it. So I think those who are already opposed to Senator Lee are not going to have their minds changed. Those who are supporting Senator Lee probably aren't going to have their minds changed either, unless it is a true bombshell. But it is interesting because there was a Hinckley Deseret News poll that came out this week that showed in a head-to-head matchup between Senator Lee and independent Evan McMullen Lee's only up by 4 points, which is just about the margin of error in this poll. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, this could have the potential to be a really tight race. And if that does end up being the case, every little misstep, every little vote matters. So we'll stay tuned.
We will stay tuned. Boy, Robert, we spent a lot of time going through this story, and I wanted to get some reporting that you did out of the way this week, and not out of the way, but to dig into it. And unfortunately, we won't have the time necessary to do that. This is about the head of the NAACP of Utah asking the Department of Justice to look into allegations of harassment and discrimination by the Salt Lake City School Board. Can you give us a sort of quick summary on that? I'm sorry, we don't have much time.
Just briefly, the NAACP asked the U.S. attorney to recommend a civil rights investigation by the Justice Department because of what the president of the NAACP says is mistreatment, a hostile work environment, and discrimination being directed at the superintendent. Tim Gadsden was the first Black superintendent hired by the district last year. And according to Janetta Williams of the NAACP, they're making and one of the board members I spoke with as well, he believes that there's a concerted effort to try to push him out by creating a hostile work environment. Now, there are other issues revolving around this we're continuing to report on. So stay tuned and follow those at sltrib.com.
Okay, Robert Gerke is news columnist with the Tribune, and this is kind of an unorthodox show. And so I'm afraid we're going to have to, you and I have exhausted our time together, but I really appreciate your joining today and hope to get you on again soon. Thanks, Robert.
Happy to do it. Take care, Roger. Yeah.
We are going to take our first break, actually, on Behind the Headlines here. But there's more to come from this past week in Utah news. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah News Roundup featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough. Now on the show, we bring in a couple of stories from the Tribune's Brian Maffley on land, water, and the environment. Here's our conversation. Brian Maffley, Tribune public lands and environment reporter, thanks again for being here. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Roger.
A couple of your stories that I'd like to tackle today. First off, there's this ecology professor down at BYU in Provo, Ben Abbott. He has been critical of a plan to dredge Utah Lake to create these islands and, you know, ostensibly to clean the lake up as well. He's looked at the plan and said it's a bad plan. The proponents of that would-be gigantic undertaking, they sued Abbott for defamation, and now he's turning the tables on them. What is he doing? What is Professor Abbott doing?
Yeah, well, he is accusing Lake Restoration Solutions, the company behind the dredging proposal, of misusing the judicial system to prevent him and possibly other critics from participating in the various public processes associated with approving this project. It's under review by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, as well as the EPA, which is an agency that Lake Restorations has gone to for nearly $1 billion in financing. Hmm.
And he is saying that they're trying to silence him with this lawsuit. And so he's filing a kind of counter lawsuit using anti-SLAPP statutes that refers to strategic lawsuits against public participation. And that's the acronym. Countersuit. What is the group behind the islands planned that Lake Restorations, what do they say about Abbott's countersuit?
Well, I mean, what they're saying is Abbott is in his statements, they have gone beyond just merely challenging the project to making factual assertions about, the quality of the scientists working on their team, where their money's coming from, whether there's a scientific basis for saying the claims that they're making. The main claim is that by dredging the lake and building these islands, they will fix its water quality problems. And that's really what's driving that whole proposal is Utah Lake, after many decades of, neglect and pollution and climate change, it's got it has parts of it are heavily contaminated with nutrients. Mm-hmm. And it has some pretty bad algal bloom episodes. It's filled with non-native fish that are in turn wreaking their own havoc and displacing native fish. So there's just myriad problems there.
Yeah.
And one of Ben Abbott's, you know, main claim, you know, and there's a lot to support this is, you know, look, we already have a lot of programs in place that are working. They are bearing fruit. We are getting rid of the Asian carp out of there. We're knocking down the Phragmites. We're restoring June sucker habitat, spending tens of millions of dollars while we're at it. Why do we need to do something so extreme as to dredge a billion cubic yards of sediment off the bed of the lake, basically just completely re-engineering its bathymetry?
Yeah.
Bathymetry. I'm not sure how to pronounce that word.
I don't know.
But they're basically re-engineering this lake, to, you know, steepening it by 7 feet, and, you know, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it is. It's a shallow lake. Average, you know, 9-10 feet, right? So this is deepening it substantially. You know, his criticisms that no one is saying is defamatory is that those could cause more harm than good.
Yeah.
Where Lake Restoration Solutions say he's crossed the line is when he's making factual assertions about the company and the project that they say aren't true.
And those assertions are... in part, one, that the company doesn't have any PhDs, working on it. And then the other is that they're getting shady or, well, let's just put it this way, seeking international financing. Do you want to just quickly address those two claims?
Yeah. So in some of Professor Abbott's assertions, which he's made in public forums before various city councils and on his blog and on social media, and that there are these Utah Lake forums that are held every few months. And he has used this term shady foreign investors or whatever. And I think it's the word shady that might be getting him in trouble. But what the company is saying is all their funding is from domestic sources. And they do have, and the other claim they make is they do have the science backing up their claims that what they'll do will actually work and clean up the lake. The problem is they've never disclosed this. They've never disclosed who their funders are or what their science is. And I think if they want to clear this up, they could do it tomorrow. Just, okay, who are you getting your money from? I think from Ben Abbott's perspective, he's like, I think he's been saying that, look, this company has made no secret that at one point it was trying to get international investors interested in the project. Well, I guess that didn't happen. So now it becomes defamatory by suggesting that they're getting their money from an international source. I personally don't see how that can be defamatory. But we'll have to let the judge figure that one out.
Brian, I guess the point of Abbott's countersuit is to try to get the defamation lawsuit that Lake Restoration is filed to get that withdrawn. Is that the point? Is that what he's trying to do?
That's the point. I mean, it's just to put a quick end to this lawsuit. It's a big distraction and a much more, very important land use issue going on for the state of Utah.
And then, Brian, where is that project? Like, where are we? I know that hasn't the state of Utah officially endorsed it? And where are we right now in the potential for this to happen?
Yeah, well, definitely the legislature has endorsed it. 4 years ago, they instructed the Department of Natural Resources to consider the proposal. And part of the proposal is, you know, when Lake Restoration creates these islands, up to 18,000 acres of islands, they'll get some of those that they can then sell for real estate. So the part of this is not just dredging the lake, but building, you know, subdivisions and parks and recreational amenities on the lake. And so the decision maker will be the Department of Natural Resources. And so they don't have the information yet to make an informed decision. In the meantime, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has started a environmental impact statement that'll take a couple years to address the potential impacts, pro and good and bad from the project. So we're kind of early on in the, still after 4 years, we're still early on in the permitting phase of this project.
There's a lot to see how this all proceeds, including just even how the suit and countersuit between Abbott and Lake Restoration Solutions play out. And I'm just going to cut you short because I know that our time is limited, and I'll thank you for those updates. And then, speaking of updates, an update to a story about Utah coal going out from the West Coast of the United States, or not going out from the West Coast of the United States. Well, actually, the story that you wrote is that coal will still be allowed out of the Richmond Terminal, Utah coal, that is, but not for very much longer, right?
Yeah. So Richmond is a city on the San Francisco Bay, and it has a deep waterfront there that Utah's largest coal producer, Wolverine Fuels, has been moving coal out of for the last few years to Japan, where the utilities there pay a lot of money for this coal, way more than what a U.S. utility would pay. So it financially would be a really good thing for this company if they could, get a permanent venue to ship coal overseas. Well, it looks like the Bay Area will no longer be an option after 2026. The city of Richmond, a few years ago, their city council banned the handling of coal on their waterfront, which triggered like more lawsuits than I can count. And the state of Utah participated in those suits on the side of the coal industry. Well, they were, kind of formally resolved a few weeks ago with a federal judge in California signing the final agreement. Basically, the company, which is Wolverine Fuels, has agreed to not fight this anymore and to stop shipping their coal out of there by the end of 2026. So while I was doing the reporting for this story, I found out, well, they've already found another place. It's called Houston on the Gulf Coast. And apparently they're able to get coal to the European market through that way. But let's face it, Houston's 1,500 miles at least. That's twice as far as the Bay Area is. And then you got to ship it, out of the Gulf, across the Atlantic.
To Europe, you said. Is that a new market for Utah coal? I mean, or maybe that's, yeah. Wow.
Well, it might not. It's a new market for Wolverine Fuels. In the 90s, Utah exported a lot of coal, and maybe some of that did get to Europe. But for the most part, it's been going across the Pacific.
Out of those ports that you
just... through the West Coast, yeah. So through, in Long Beach was another option for a while. Where they really were hoping to play score big was to develop a terminal in Oakland, which is a few miles down the waterfront from Richmond. There's an old army base at the foot of the Bay Bridge, and the coal companies in Utah got developed a kind of a partnership with those developers to build this bulk export terminal that would ship 10 million tons of coal a year. That's considering Utah's currently is only producing 12 or 13 tons of coal a year, that would basically enable Utah to really ramp up its production. And and apparently, again, the city of Oakland stepped in and said, no, you're not doing that. And it resulted in a lot of lawsuits, which Oakland lost and the coal industry won. However, the project in the interim went bankrupt, and it doesn't look like it has much hope of being revived in any kind of way that would involve coal exports. There's not a lot of good options for getting coal out of the West Coast.
Brian,
it looks like getting off of Houston's a lot easier way to do it.
Though still very expensive. I was going to, the sort of story over the past few years has been that coal hasn't been competitive. There hasn't been a market, but several of the things you have said in this interview make me think that there is actually a market for coal. I guess is the predicted demise of this resource, or of the mining and extraction and burning of this resource, premature?
Well, I think there's a lot of agreement that the sun is setting on coal because of its impact on the climate. It just, so much carbon dioxide gets emitted when you burn it. But right now, there's a lot of disruption in the energy markets, in part because of the war in Ukraine. And I think at the end of the day, you know, I mean, if we're not going to develop nuclear power, it, you know, these energy needs need to be taken care of with something. And, you know, coal has been readily available for a long time. The problem is there's just a lot of political opposition to exporting it. And the environmental impacts associated with, you know, mining it, transporting it, burning it, getting rid of the ash that comes out. I mean, all along that stream with coal, there are just huge environmental impacts. So, you know, if industry has to pay for those impacts, then it won't be attractive. But if you can socialize those impacts and put them on the rest of the world, then coal does have a future.
All right. Brian Maffley, we will rely on you to continue to tell us where this industry is headed in Utah, and we really appreciate your reporting. So thanks for joining me on the show, and keep it up.
Yeah, thank you, Roger. Take care.
And you can find both of the articles that Brian and I discussed at sltrib.com. There's more in those stories than we were able to get to, and so, yeah, read your local paper. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We will take a quick break and be back with a conversation about the Utah Jazz. That is in just a minute's time. Stay with us.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah News Roundup featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune over the past week. Now, a conversation about the departure of Utah Jazz coach Quinn Snyder and about Jazz rumors with Andy Larson. Jazz beat writer Andy Larson, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
So big Jazz news this week. Quinn Snyder is leaving as head coach. And, you know, let's get this out of the way first. Why is he leaving? Is that even clear?
It's not incredibly clear, but he gave some kind of hints in his press conference, you know, and in statements after. First of all, you know, in his statement, he said that he felt that the team needed a new voice. And then in an article with Gordon Monson, one of our Tribune columnists, said that he just couldn't find a path forward. And I think those kind of statements together are pretty revealing in terms of, you know, kind of realizing that this last Jazz year was really tough for him, was maybe some of the hardest days of his tenure. And he didn't find that he was having a lot of success with his messaging, you know, like, you know, he, despite the team disappointing and doing his best, he couldn't do anything to improve that scenario. So I think it's a tough thing. You know, obviously he'd been the coach for 8 years, the fourth longest tenured coach in the NBA right now. But he couldn't find a way that, like, hey, how do you make the Jazz better? How do you make them a championship contending team in the near future? Quinn didn't see a path there. And so chose to step down rather than kind of beat his head against the wall.
I want to get to his legacy, and I want to talk about the coaches who may come next. But I, you know, the fact that it's not 100% clear, and that we have this sense of why he's leaving, the fact that he, you know, it's not resulting, I guess, in getting further along in the playoffs and to a more successful track record in the end, though it was relatively successful compared to other coaches. All of that is sort of fuel for the rumor mill, and man, there have been a lot of rumors about the Jazz over the past, you know, year or two. And I guess, you know, beyond the idea that he is leaving because of the fact that he's not getting anywhere, I'm wondering if you have any other sort of speculation as to why he left. I've seen some rumors out there that are, you know, maybe about relationships and so on and so forth. Is that outside of your, you know, your MO to speculate about other reasons why he might be leaving?
No, Roger, I love speculating. But I think, like, no, I think essentially this season was difficult in terms of those relationships too, right? Like, I think his relationship with Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert, by all accounts, were still very positive, and yet weren't as effective in kind of changing their games or in terms of kind of leading to linear improvement like they had been in years past. And then, you know, I think there are relationships on the other end of the scale, right, with his bosses, with management. And, you know, with that, I'll say, like, he had 6 or 7 years with kind of the Miller family and Dennis Lindsay in charge, and kind of had, and especially Steve Starks as liaison, and had kind of figured out how to operate in that way. And indeed, the Millers kind of gave him a lot of trust, right? Like they allowed him to design the Zions Bank basketball campus, the Jazz's practice facility. They allowed him to kind of change personnel around and to bring different people into the basketball operations department and obviously his coaching staff as well. And so I think in the end, it was, these were new relationships with guys he didn't maybe know as well, Ryan Smith and Danny Ainge.
Yeah.
And that was, while I don't think he has any like ill will towards Ryan or Danny, it's just kind of maybe he didn't have those kind of same relationships to try to push through this difficult time like he may have for the Miller family.
I guess a last point on this is that Quinn cited philosophical differences with the front office to a certain extent. I'm wondering if that means that he saw that the best way to a championship was to build the team around Rudy Gobert and not Donovan Mitchell. But the front office said, no, this is our star. We got to stick with him.
Well, Quinn publicly said no philosophical differences. That was in his statement. Reporting on that said there were philosophical differences. I don't know what the truth is on that.
Got it. And here I am forcing you to speculate. And so thanks for doing that, Andy. I'm actually going to stay in this vein. I still want to get back to who we might see as the next coach. But on the other part of the rumor mill around the Jazz, I sort of half-heartedly follow the Jazz Twitterverse myself. And it seems like every week or two I get someone, breaking the news that Donovan Mitchell wants out of the Utah Jazz. One headline I read said, Donovan will do whatever it takes to get out of Utah. Is it too much to ask you bluntly if that's true or false?
I don't think that he will do whatever it takes to get out of Utah. Frankly, if he was, he would be doing more. And that being said, I don't think that he is, particularly likely to stay in Utah beyond his next deal. He still has 3 years left on his contract with the Jazz. And it's going to be really interesting. I think that if he were a free agent today, I don't think that he's returning to the Jazz. And I do think that kind of keeping Donovan happy or trying to make him more happy than he was this last season, whether that's by hiring a coach that appeals to him, whether that's by improving the roster around him, frankly, kind of changing the conversation there in any way, may kind of make him happier. And if not, then, frankly, then it's time to move on. Then it's time to, if you kind of really do give it another go with another core or make moves to kind of satisfy him and it still doesn't work out, then you still have this 1 or 2 year window where you can successfully trade him and get a lot back. So, I think basically the length of remaining years he has on his contract gives the Jazz multiple outs there where, they can see if they can make Donovan happier and kind of keep a really good young player in Utah for the foreseeable future. And if not, then you still have the flexibility to move on if you need to.
I'm going to squeeze in one more rumor here before I turn to that some of the reporting you did on Donovan and the power that he has at the team. But that other persistent rumor, it's either Donovan or Rudy on the team going forward, but not both. Andy, true or false? Or, Magic 8-Ball says it's unclear. What's the answer there?
I do think it's fair to say that Rudy doesn't expect to return. And I think the Jazz are definitely looking for different trade possibilities with him. I think some of the, Rudy Gobert hates Donovan Mitchell and vice versa stuff is a little bit overblown. I think they're coworkers that don't especially like each other more than like pure hatred and refuse to play with each other moving forward. But I also do think that the overwhelming consensus is that kind of this core has run its course, and that given that this last season was disappointing, given that there's an aging core around them, that the only way that the Jazz can get better without draft picks this year and with no free agent space is to make a trade with one of their best players or maybe even both. And so I think that is definitely what the Jazz are exploring over the next few weeks and really probably most of the offseason. And then, I don't expect both Rudy and Donovan to be back with the Jazz next year.
You know, I know that there's sensitive feelings and you know, ultimately this is a game of basketball. It's people's livelihoods as well, though, and they get moved around the country and do what they do. But I'm going to squeeze in another question here before we turn to the reporting that you did, which is that you, Andy, have had your criticism of Donovan's playing and also some of the role that he has at the Jazz. And I'm wondering, I mean, a friend of mine actually asked me to ask you this, which is, if it is ultimately that they are trading Rudy but not Donovan, do you think that that's the right decision? And then is the criticism that you have of our star guard out of the hope that he improves, or do you think it's just not going to work and that Donovan himself should be traded? Is that too blunt a question to ask a reporter?
No, so I guess two different questions there. One, you know, are the Jazz improved if they trade Rudy and not Donovan? No, you know, like Rudy Gobert is, you know, at least statistically the most impactful player on the team towards winning. But, you know, it does make some sense to trade him now before he turns 30 later on this month, before his contract explodes to, you know, being $40 million a year. You know, I think there are some kind of basketball reasons it makes sense to trade Rudy Gobert now and say, hey, yeah, maybe you take a step back this upcoming season, but you get younger. You can save some money under the cap and give yourself some flexibility moving forward. That doesn't make the Jazz championship contenders, but it, you know, you can kind of see a path forward there where the Jazz are in many ways kind of stuck right now. And then with the criticism of Donovan, you know, like I still kind of believe that Donovan is a well-intentioned young guy. I like Donovan personally. I think we've had interesting conversations. You know, I think he has, I don't want to say changed, but maybe changed his outlook over the last couple of years. You know, I think as most people have, you know, I think the pandemic changed some of his thoughts on Utah. I think the Black Lives Matter movement and kind of Utah's response to it in a lot of ways has changed his feelings about the state. I think his, you know, Stuart Adams attacking him, I think did matter to Donovan. And so, you know, I think he's also kind of exploring that space in new ways than he did when he was 22, you know? And I also expect kind of the Donovan when he's 28 or 30 or 32 years old to be different and more mature than this one. But I guess that's kind of a, maybe a more subtle way of answering your question, but yeah. Like, I do think that some of the things he's done recently are worthy of criticism, but I don't think that he's like a irredeemable individual. You know, I think he is a complicated person with understandable wants and needs.
I'm just going to clarify that Stuart Adams, when you talk about Stuart Adams, that's the Senate president, and he was critical of Donovan Mitchell's criticism of the legislature's discussion of critical race theory and their sort of attacks on that concept. I'm going to steer us away from this. I'm sorry to go down that rabbit hole there, but thank you for answering those questions, Andy. And, you know, after Quinn's announcement, I want to break down something else that you reported, which is that ESPN said that Donovan Mitchell was, quote unquote, unnerved and surprised at the announcement by Coach Quinn. And you saw this as the star guard putting pressure on the team. Can you explain your theory there? This has to do with who might become the next head coach.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So obviously who the next head coach is up in the air. And I think that it's a wide open process for the Jazz. But it was a little bit suspicious that the kind of news of how Donovan felt about Quinn's departure came out so quickly and came out through the source it did, which is essentially Donovan Mitchell is represented by Creative Artists Agency, which we'll call CAA, as is Adrian Wojnarowski at ESPN, the reporter who kind of released this anonymously sourced report saying what Donovan believed, as is Johnny Bryant, who is a former Jazz assistant coach, currently the Knicks lead assistant coach, and is considered one of the lead candidates for this job. And so, you know, you kind of put the tea leaves together and say, hey, it doesn't make a lot of sense for Donovan to be surprised and kind of as publicly aghast about this as he seemed to be, unless something is being angled for. And you know, I think you can kind of go one of two ways there. Either he's angling just to, frankly, just get out from the Jazz, which I think is possible, or, you know, more likely, and because it was maybe a little bit more subtle than just like a trade demand would be, I think he does have interest in who his next boss is and who the next coach of the Utah Jazz is. And I do think Johnny Bryant, given his positive relationship with working with Donovan over the first 3-4 years of his career, that he would welcome Johnny to be his head coach. And so I think there are kind of these ties there, kind of the bigger picture there, that make some of the reporting that happened over the weekend make more sense than it kind of does as individual points in a vacuum.
All right, last question, since I've been asking for your opinion this entire interview. Are you sorry to see Quinn go, or was it, you know, in your mind, as Quinn put it, time?
Both. I am sorry to see him go. I really liked Quinn, and yet I also kind of agree with his conclusion that there's probably not a path forward for him with this team and kind of imagining how that rebuild would work. You know, honestly, if I could, it would be, yes, have Quinn take that year off, go through this year without him, and then bring him back as a player development coach. He brought the Jazz from worst in the Western NBA's Western Conference to first 2 seasons ago, you know? So yeah. I think there was something accomplished there, and I think he is a great builder of things. But given kind of the teardown that I think is to come, or some of the struggles that could be coming, you know, it didn't make sense to necessarily have him in charge.
Where do you think he'll go?
I don't know. I do think he takes a year off and decides after that.
Great. Andy Larson, Jazz Beat reporter, really appreciate your analysis on this. And thanks for joining.
No worries. Thanks, Roger.
The Tribune's Andy Larson there. Since we didn't make room for our normal underplayed story segment, I'll just add that Andy, who also works as what you might call a data columnist for the Trib, had a story that broke down 25 years of airfare data leaving the Salt Lake International Airport. Offers some interesting tidbits on how to find cheap flights. So check that out and all of the other stories that we tackled today over at sltrib.com. And that does it for Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Subscribe to our podcast in your podcast app. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend and join us again next week.